And we're holding on page Choftes in Ksubas, the paragraph Shom Oma Ola, towards the end of Ois Dalad. We learned yesterday all about the Birkas Avelin, the Birkas Rechava, as the Gemara calls it, the special bracha or a series of brachas that they would say when a person is an Avelus, Rahman al-Islam. So we talked about, the Gemara had gotten into it by way of talking about that you have to have a minion present for that, similar to the way you have to have a minion present for Birkas Chasanim. So continuing on that topic, the Gemara says, Oma Ula, Va'amilo Masnusatona, Ula said, or some say we learn in a Braisa, Asara Koisis Tiknu Chachamim Beveitza Ovel. The Chachamim established that there should be 10 cups of wine drunk in the house of the Ovel during the meal. During each meal. Shloisha Kodim Achila, 3 before the main meal while they're eating appetizers and whatnot. Kedelif Toyach has B'nei Meyav to open up the stomach and wet the appetite. The Gemara mentions in Psachim, in fact, that drinking of a little amount of wine makes a person feel full, but then drinking more wine stimulates the appetite. The Gemara mentions, for example, that Rava would drink a lot of wine on Erev Pesach, so he'd have an appetite for the matzah by the Seder. So here also, you have 3 cups of wine to stimulate the appetite. Shloisha b'seich achila, then 3 during the meal itself, g'delishris achila shemeyav, in order to soak up and soften the food in the stomach. Drinking with your food helps with digestion. And then another 4 after the meal. Why 4 after the meal when we had 3 and 3? So now the 4 after the meal are echad keneged hazon, ve'echad keneged birkas ha'aretz, ve'echad keneged bani yushlaim, ve'echad keneged atoy v'ameitiv, 1 corresponding to each of the 4 brachas of benching. So Rashi explains, after each bracha, he would drink the cup, and then they would pour him another one. So instead of like we have when we bench on a kois, we make a bracha, a gofen, at the end, and drink it then. Here, by Beisa Ovo, the Chachamim had made the takana that you would have 1 cup, that they would have 1 cup after each bracha. That's according to Rashi. Marsha points out, why more by an oval than anybody else? The fact that you need to stimulate the appetite and to help with digestion, that applies to everybody, but why particularly 4 after the meal, just in connection with the 4, with the 4 brachas of benching? So Marsha explains like this. As we learned yesterday, there's a certain connection between death and drinking a cup. Like we talked about yesterday, there are various psukim in Tillim and in Yirmiyah and other places that refer to punishments from Hashem as described as drinking a bitter cup. We have the Lashon in Yehuda Bar Nachmeni's in one of his brachas, where you Rabim Shosu, Rabim Yishtu, etc., that whole Nusach over there. So here in the same vein then, we're saying that we need, now there are 4 cups representing the 4 cups of Puranus that Hashem is going to punish the Goyim with, Psukim, and in particular in Sefer Yirmiyah, that talk about this idea of the Kos Puranus that Hashem is going to give the Goyim. It refers to 4 then, 4 such cups. The Pashtus representing the 4 Malchias or whatever. Anyway, so here also corresponding to that, we want to have 4 cups corresponding to that. So you find also, by the way, you find by the Salamashkin's dream in this parasha, you find 4 times it mentions Kos, and in fact the Yerushalmi says that's one of the sources for why we have Dalad Kosas on Pesach. So as long as we need to have 4 koses, then the Chachamim said, you know what, you have 4 brachas in benching, then let's associate the 4 cups with the 4 brachas and do like Rashi says and have him drink 1 cup after each bracha. Then, hoisifu aleihem abba. Eventually, the Chachamim decided we should add another 4. So now altogether there's going to be 14 cups drunk. Yeah. Echad keneged chazonei ha'ir, 1 in honor of the chazonim of the city. Now, chazonim in Gemara terminology generally does not mean what we think of as a chazan, as in the one who davens by the omer. In Gemara terminology, chazan usually means the shamoshim of the city. So Rashi explains they're the chevra kadisha. They're the ones who deal with burying the mason and doing other necessities for the tzibur. So therefore, we have a cup of wine to in honor of them. Now, Maharsha adds, so here, so we had four cups keneged, the four cups of punishment that Hashem is going to give all the goyim who harassed us over the years. Now we have, they added four brachas representing the Yeshua v'nechama of the Jewish people. The same four cups that Hashem is going to punish the goyim, there's also going to be corresponding to that four cups of goodness for us Jewish people. So now we have, they set it up like this. So, and the idea being, Maharsha says it might be like they would make a l'chaim on each cup in honor of the person, in honor of the group that's going to be named here. So they would drink the one cup and then say l'chaim, or the way the Gemara phrases it elsewhere, chamer v'chayeh, wine and life. That would be their version of l'chaim in honor of the chazonei ha'ir, who are helping with burying the mason and doing other tzorchei tzibur. The echad keneged parnosi ha'ir, another one in honor of the parnosim of the city. These are, Rashi describes, these are the rich people of the city. They're the ones who contribute tzedakah towards the burial of poor people. So again, Maharsha explains, they would be saying, they would be drinking a cup and saying l'chaim in honor of the parnosi ha'ir, who again, in many cases, are helping out with the burial over here. The echad keneged beis hamikdash, a third one that we're looking forward to the building of the beis hamikdash, that we're mourning for the beis hamikdash, like the way here, the people are mourning for their mess. So therefore, it's appropriate to have in here a special thing in honor of that we look forward to the restoration of the beis hamikdash, and meanwhile we're mourning for it, just as they're mourning now for their mess. The echad keneged Rav Gamliel, and a fourth one in honor of Rav Gamliel. Why specially Rav Gamliel? The Gemara is going to explain in a couple of lines. Anyway, so the point is, so you'd have four extra brachas where they would be saying a l'chaim for each one of those, Maharsha explains. The problem is, that's a lot of wine. That's 14 cups of wine, so people were getting drunk. So they restored it to the way it was originally. So Rashi explains, and the Rambam also explains, that when we say L'Yoshna, it means they went back to the original method of 10 cups. That's not so bad, especially most of them are during or after the meal. They don't get a person as drunk, so it's not so bad. There are other Mefarshim who learn that it means, in fact, Techziru Adrava L'Yoshna, they took away this whole concept of having extra cups of wine by the Beis HaOvel. And you see, nowadays, right, by Beis HaOvel, when they're having the Sodas Avra, or the other meals that are taking place during the week, where people bring them food, you don't have 10 cups of wine, you don't necessarily they have any cups of wine with them. B'chol, we're not in the habit of drinking wine like the way they were used to.
That goes to in our days.
What, to drink wine?
Yeah.
No, so during the 9 days, we don't drink wine. That's a special kind of thing. That's because of the Avelos. For the Beis Mikdash, then we don't drink wine. In particular, there's an idea, there's a Gemara in Baba Basra that mentions that after the Churban, there were some people who thought, you know, we should never eat meat and drink wine again, because those are brought as karbonis. And Rabbi Yeshua has to explain to them, if you're going to go like that, you can't eat bread either, because there was a lachem upon him, and you're not going to be able to eat fruit, because there was bikurim, and even wine, because there's chamayim, and he explains to them that that's not the way to do it. We have to have a certain minhagim of avelos, but we have to still be able to continue with our lives normally. So during the 9 days, then at least we do that. We don't drink wine as a siman of avelos for the Beis Mikdash. But when it comes to regular avelos, the oval is allowed to drink wine, as we see here in our Gemara, but this minhag of the 10 or 14 cups no longer exists. So, my Rav Gamliel, we said that one of the extra four cups that they would do was in honor of Rav Gamliel. Why specifically him? So the Tanya, we learn a brisa, but he's shown a hoisa hitzas a mess kosher lekrev of yosem misasei. Originally, the burial of the mess was even harder on his relatives than his actual death. As bad as the death of their relative was, the funeral was that they considered a lot worse, because people were burying their mason in expensive garments. Rashi mentions, for example, they were using silk or other things like that. So it was getting to be such an expense that people were having a hard time with it. It was getting to the point where people were leaving the mess and running away so they're not on the hook for paying for expensive tachrichim. Ad shavaram gamliel. By the way, though, the Maharam learns from this that lahalacha, you see that the krovim, that the relatives, are in fact the ones who are generally on the hook for paying for the expenses of the funeral. We don't say that it's something for the tzibur to collect. If they don't have, then we said before, the parnosim step in and help. But generally speaking, it's expected that the relatives are the ones who pays for these things. Anyway, so they were finding the expense too much. And you can imagine also, you know, what was actually, you don't have to imagine, Maharsha points evidence out. Also, what was happening is that the rich people were using expensive clothing like this. So now the poorer people, you know, you always have to keep up with the Joneses, as they say. So therefore, they felt the pressure to also use more expensive things in order to be as much as possible like the rich. And it was getting to be too much of a financial burden for them. Achabodam Gamliel, the Nog Kalos Basmoy, until Ram Gamliel came and acted in a way of Kalos, in a way of showing like less respect, like showing not merely less respect, but like showing a more lenient way of doing it, Basmoy, about himself. Don't bury me, he says to his family. Don't bury me in expensive clothing, just bury me in cheap Tachrichim. They brought him out to be buried in Tachrichim made out of linen, which is relatively cheap. And then the minhag after that developed that everybody does that, but they use tachrichim made out of linen, which is a lot cheaper. So now the Avelim, so there was a period of time when the Avelim were saying a special l'chaim in honor of Rav Gamliel, that he brought down these wedding expenses, like, and I mean these funeral expenses like this. So the Papa says nowadays, in his time, or a couple hundred years later, people are knowing that they bury their mesim even in clothing of cheap canvas, which is worth only a zuz. So even cheaper than linen. Lamaisa, the universal minhag nowadays, is to use linen, and specifically white linen. There's an idea, Alpi Kabbalah, there's particular ideas behind the use of that, Davka. Anyway, so that was Ram Gamliel's contribution. Interesting to mention in this connection, by the way, the Maharsha is mentioning this idea that before Ram Gamliel, you had the rich people were burying expensive clothing, and the poor people felt the social pressure to try to match them in that as well. There is a story that's actually told involving the Maharsha, actually involving in his times a similar thing that was going on in one of the Kehillos where he was the Rav, where the rich people started getting this idea. They have to go to the mikveh, they have to go to the bathhouse or whatever. They would hire people to carry their clothes to the mikveh or the bathhouse for them. And again, it was the same kind of idea. The rich people can afford it, the poor people couldn't, but there was a social pressure, and therefore it was getting very difficult. Maharsha finally, as the rov of the city, steps in and bans the whole thing. There's one particular rich guy over there, Chutzpanyak, who says that rule doesn't apply to me. And Maharsha puts him in his place, basically. The whole story over there, he calls down on him smoke, minashamayim, that ruins all his clothing and everything that's being carried, and the guy learns his lesson, you don't start up with the shatrav. But this is an example also where the Maharsha realized it's one thing if the rich people were doing it and they're keeping it to themselves, fine, but the fact is it's bringing about that the poorer people are feeling the necessity to do this kind of thing as well, and you can't do that. Ashad afidishagil. All right. So now going back to the Mishnah had begun with the idea, as we learned the other day, that Besula is supposed to be married on Wednesday and the first Bia on Wednesday night going into Thursday. And the official reason was, we said that if the husband has Tainas Besulim, if he has a complaint, he finds that his wife is not a Besula, then he'll go to Beis Din and get the whole thing hashed out over there. And since Bat Dinim sit on Monday and Thursday, so therefore if they get married on Wednesday, then he'll be able to go there first thing in the morning before he has a chance to just make his peace with it. Now, on the one hand, fine. I mean, we might want, there should be shalom bias between them, but on the other hand, if there was nus over here, we got to get it hashed out. We have to have edim, whatever. So therefore we want him to be able to go to Beis Din as soon as possible. So that leads the Gemara into a sugya about the question: if he does find her a besula, is that enough? Or if he finds her not a besula, rather, is that enough to make her also to him, or do we need actual evidence of his nus? And the Gemara goes through a whole discussion on the subject. Eventually, that leads the Gemara into mentioning the story of Bathsheba and David. So we know Bathsheba was married to Uriah. David calls her to the palace, and he has relations with her, and everything develops from there. So the Gemara mentions now there were no edim that there were people knew that she had been brought to the palace. There was no edim though that they had actually had relations. So the Gemara just. So just like this, the way the Pesukim describe the story is that David had her brought to the palace while Uriah was still alive. afterwards when she tells Dovid, I'm pregnant, then Dovid is trying to cover up the whole thing, and therefore he calls Urya back from the battle, and to make a long story short, he decides that he's a murdered Malchus, and he has him sent back to the battle and killed in battle over there. Now, so the Gemara is going to explain, as we're going to talk about now, that Urya had given Bathsheba a get beforehand. It's Machlokas Rashi and Tosfos, whether it was a conditional get or an unconditional get. I was going to bring that point over here. Yeah. Rashi here and in other places in Shas, this is mentioned in Shabbos, it's mentioned in Gittin, that Rashi learns in all those places that this get was a conditional get. He writes in the get, if he dies in war, or if he's missing, or if he's missing in action, then the get should take effect as of when it's retroactive to when it's written. Tosfos in all these places, including here, discusses that and says that actually wouldn't work out, that wouldn't work in this case. It wouldn't help to mitigate what Dovid had done to take away the issue of Eshes Ish. And therefore, Tosfos learns it was an unconditional get. It was a plain old get. He's divorcing her. That's that. Elamai, they would do it betsina. They would do it in private so that it doesn't become well known. So that way, when they come back from war, they'll be able to remarry their wives. If the wife gets remarried to somebody else in between, then she's also to return to her first husband, as we know from Psukim in Parshas Tisei. So they would do this with Sina, and that way she would wait for her husband to come back, and only if he doesn't come back, then she'd feel herself free to go and marry somebody else. Anyway, so the Gemara in this connection mentions, so the Gemara discusses the point that why is it, now we know there's a concept, Kishem Shasur Labal, Kahasur Laboil, that when a married woman is Mizana, she's also to her husband, she's also to the man that she had relations with. So how is it that she doesn't become also to David? So this is before we get into the matter of the get. So first, the Gemara answers that it was a matter of oinus. Rishonim argue, does that mean literally oinus in the sense that David forced her? Or does it mean, Parsha, she's a ketana, the Gemara mentions in Sanhedrin, that she was a girl at the time, and therefore, you know, pitri ketana oinusu, as the Gemara expresses it, that a ketana is not really able to give consent, and with her it's always considered oinus. So Mephoshim discuss what the Gemara means by that exactly. Anyway, then the Gemara gives the second answer, which is what we're going to have over here in the Gemara, which is what we're going to have over here in Ein Yaakov, that Urya had given her a get, and therefore that she's not an Eshes Ish. Again, according to Rashi, that retroactively it'll turn out she wasn't an Eshes Ish because Urya did die in battle. And according to Tosfos, that anyway, it was an unconditional get, and therefore she's divorced at the time anyhow. So the Gemara says, Omer of Shmuel b'Nachmeni, Omer of Yonason, Kol ha-yotzev ha-lochemes beis David, anybody who goes out to fight the wars of beis David, he writes out a get krisus to his wife. Conditional according to Rashi, unconditional according to Tosfos. Dichtiv, as the Pasuk says, Ve'esachecha tifkod l'shalom, the Pasuk says, much earlier when David's brothers have gone to war against the Plishtim, and David stayed home, he was tending Yishai's sheep, and then one day Yishai tells him, go take some food to your brothers in the Machna, we learned about this in Yevamos, and then David comes there, and he finds out that Goliath is standing over there, and then mocking the Jewish people every day, and he offers to go fight against him, and everything develops from there. Anyway, Yishai's instruction to David includes the words. He says, "Vesachecha tifkod l'shalom." You should find out your brother's shalom, find out how they're doing. Vesarubosam tikach, and take their aruba. Now my vesarubosam tikach. What does that phrase mean? Simple meaning, Mephoshim talk about in the Pasuk, it means it's also part of finding out how they're doing, find out that everything is orev, is pleasant with them. It can mean some of the Mephoshim explain, like this, for example, they may have run short of food at some point, so they had to buy things on credit from the camp canteen and give them a mashkin for it. So now Yishai is telling David, go bring money over there so you can redeem their mashkinus. But the Gemara is taking it in a different sense. My vessel was This means things that are blended between him and her, meaning the marriage is a blend between the husband and the wife. And now, so this is the kiddushin, tikach, take it away from them, from your brothers, meaning in other words, remove the effect of those kiddushin via a get. So therefore, in other words, Yishai is telling David, have your brothers write out gittin for their wives in order that, again, if they die or are missing in battle, then their wives are not agunas. So the vote would be, why is the Gemara calling it Milchamas Beis David? So either one explanation is, now this is David wasn't yet king when that story happened. So either what it means is Yishai developed that minhag, he's the one who came up with that idea, and later on, when David became king, years later, then he implemented it as official policy in the army. So that's what they're saying. So one explanation is that in Yishai's times, obviously around Melchamas Beis David, David had only just been anointed when the story happened. So no, one explanation is it means Yishai was the one who first came up with this Hamtzah, that the soldiers should write a gittin to their wives to avoid problems of Igun. Then when David himself became king a few years later, then he implemented that he made that official policy in the army. From now on, anybody who serves in the army has to write a get krisis. The other way of explaining it is that when the Gemara says Milchamas Beis David, doesn't mean specifically of Beis David, it means any Milchamas mitzvah, any valid Milchama that the Jewish people are fighting, then it would be included that they would do this, they would write a get krisis. So the point the Gemara is making is, according to that way of looking at it, then there's no reason to ask why is Bathsheba not also to David after the fact, because when David had relations with her, she's not, in fact, an Eishes Ish, whether retroactively according to Rashi, or actually, in fact, right now, according to Tosfos. Marshall points out, Marshall refers over here to what he says on this in Masechta Shabbos, that, well, actually, he doesn't refer to it, but whatever. You look in Masechta Shabbos, Marsha points out about it. The whole point was, we're saying they're supposed to do that before they go to war. But Yishai says to David, apparently your brothers forgot to do that this time. So now, after the fact, you're anyway going to bring them food and supplies and whatever. So while you're at it, go have them write out those gittin that they should have done before, and they forgot to before they went to war. Worth mentioning now in connection with your test Kislev that you have the famous mimer that the Rebbe Rashab said regarding the Chayolei Beis David, regarding the students of Tumcha Tmimim, that they're the ones who are going out on Milchamas Beis David to fight against all of the anti Torah forces and movements and whatever of that time and of our times, and everybody has to write a get krisus l'ishta. In other words, that a person has to be ready to cut himself off from his gashmiyistic pleasures and devote himself to what the Eibishta wants as brought to us through the Rabbein. Further on, the Gemara talks about like this. Now, we're saying that the husband might have a tainus besulim. He might have a complaint that then he goes to Beis Din that his wife's not a besula and what's going on. And there could be a lot of possibilities, of course. Some of them, which would make, she might even be chayiv misa, might be that he'd be able to claim mekach tos, etc., etc. Anyway, one thing, the Gemara begins the discussion by pointing out that there are two kinds of things that you would expect to find by a besula, which the husband might claim that he doesn't find evidence of one or the other of them. One is that she bleeds when they first have relations because the besula are broken, and the other one is a certain tightness, which the Gemara calls that if he doesn't find it, he calls it pesach pasuach matzasi, that he found it's not as tight in that area as you would expect. So the Gemara goes through a discussion about various cases where people came to, where new chassanim came to Beis Din with tainus about one or the other of these. And in a number of cases, the Gemara brings where a person comes and says, Ba'alti, v'le matzasi dam, I had relations with my kala the first time, and I didn't find any blood. So here the Gemara gives one of those stories. So here the Ein Yaakov gives one of those stories from the Gemara. Ahuda osel kamed Ram Gamliel Azokin. A newly married chassan comes to Ram Gamliel Azokin. Omalay, he says, Rebbe, Ba'alti, v'le matzasi dam, I had relations with my kala, and I didn't find blood, and therefore I suspect that she wasn't a basula. Omalay, so she said, the kala, says to Rabbi Gamliel, Rebbe, mimishpachas durkati ani. You should know that I'm from the family of durkati. The Gemara is going to explain soon what durkati means. She'en lahen lo dam nidor v'lo dam basulim. That family is a hereditary thing. They don't have dam nidor, or they have very little, and they don't have dam basulim. So therefore, he didn't find blood. That's just because that's the genetics of my family, but not that I wasn't a basula. Bodak Rav Gamliel b'kribisera, so Rav Gamliel made an investigation among her female relatives to ask, do they have the same kind of thing as well? Do they also not have dam nida and dam basulim? Umotza kibbareha, and he found, like what she says, they taka don't have that. Omalei, so he tells the chosin, lech zechei b'mekachatha. Go and be zoicha in your acquisition, meaning, in other words, go ahead, have a nice, successful, happy life with your kala. And he tells him, in fact, Ashrecha shezachis al mishpachas durkati. You should consider yourself fortunate that you were zoicha to marry into the family of durkati. So the Gemara says, my durkati, where does that name come from? And the answer is durkatua. It means a cut off generation. So Rashi explains, and it means that they're cut off from the way of normal women. Most women have dam nida, most women have dam basulim, and the women of this family do not for some genetic reason. So therefore they're called durkati, as in like they're cut off from the experience of most women. Marsha brings from the Oruch that it means another thing as well. The Gemara is going to point out now that where there's a lack of dam nida and dam basulim means the women are going to be less fertile. So it means therefore this family is katua, as in cut off, as it's less likely she's going to end up having children. In fact, Rav Hanina says when Rav Gamliel says to the guy, "Lech tev makachacha, go consider yourself fortunate that you married into this family of durkati." So in fact, he was giving him empty consolation. In fact, it's not such a good thing. The Tony Rav Chia, as in fact Rav Chia teaches in a Braisa, Kishem Shasur Yofala Isa, just as much as sourdough is good for bread, it makes the bread fluffy and tasty. Kach Domin Yofalisha, Yofan Lisha, the same way blood is good for the woman. Now the blood ultimately it comes from where Chava was punished with after the Chetei Tadas, but the fact is once that was done, then that blood it shows that the woman is fertile. It shows that she's capable of how she's a bas bonim. The Tonim is Shum Remeir, as in fact we learn in a Braise in the name of Remeir, called Isha Shadameha Merubin, Baneha Merubin, a woman who has more blood from Dam Nida and whatever is going to have more children. So because in other words, it shows that everything's working normally in her body. So this woman from a family of Durkati, fine, it means that she was a Basula. It means that the guy doesn't have a complaint of Tainus Basulin, but nevertheless, he shouldn't consider himself so fortunate that his wife is from that family, because the fact is it may mean that she's going to have difficulty conceiving children. The Gemara actually goes on to point out, it's not here in Ein Yaakov, but the Gemara points out, on the other hand, there is a good side in it, and therefore it's maybe not such tanchumim shel hevel. There is a positive side in it, that he has a wife from that family. It means there's never going to be an issue of suffik nida. Like this, when a woman's wife, when a man's wife is vadai nida, okay, he knows, look, you know, she's off limits and that. When she's suffik nida, we're going to have an example of that later in the Masechta, in Perachelet. When she's a suffik nida, he's likely to start second guessing. Well, is she really nida? Maybe not. Maybe I can cut corners over here. So therefore, when there's no possibility of suffik nida, because as it is, she has very little bleeding, then you avoid that kind of problem.
What's the suffix?
Sometimes, there's all kinds of cases that are described. There's all kinds of cases that are described in Masechta Nida. She finds blood on a part of her body or on her clothing, and you're not sure. There can be the color. There can be you're not sure whether in the position where it's found on the clothing, whether it actually came from the uterus or whether it came from somewhere else. There's all kinds of things in it. We don't have to get into the anatomy lesson right now, but yeah, suffice it to say that there are many cases. Cases of suffix nida, okay. Fine. The next Mishnah in the Perek over here in the Gemara deals with the fact that the ksuba, the amount of money that's pledged in the ksuba, is different for a besula versus a non-besula. 200 zuz minimum for a besula, 100 zuz minimum for an almona, which includes any woman who's had relations before, almona, grusha, etc. The Gemara says, "My almana. Why is a widow called in Lashon Kodesh almana?" There's a variety of explanations among the Mefoshim what the point of the question is. I mean, it's a word like anything else. But there's a lot of things. One of them is Mela, for example. We understand the shortish of it, Elaim, Aleph Lamed Mem, means a mute person who can't speak, because like she has nobody to speak up for her, and therefore like she's silent because she's an almana. But where do we get the nun and the hay from? And there are a number of other explanations what the point of the question is. Anyway, Omer Abchana Bagadta Almana Al Shem Mona. She's called an almana because of the mona, because of 100 zuz that she's entitled to for her ksuba. Which there's some Mephoshim explain, in other words, that it means, in other words, like this, that she gets a mona as her ksuba. Others explain that it means fakert, al mona, removing, not a mona, meaning, in other words, that she loses out one mona out of the two mona, the 200 zuz that she would have gotten as a basola. The Rashash says even, he says kind of a funny thing, you know, in Arabic you have all over the place where al means is like hey in Lashon Kodesh, it means the. So al mana can be understood, you know, almost the mana, almost as if you're using al as a definite article. Anyway, the point is, in other words, that, So Maharsha points out, you have a man who's lost his wife, Rahman al-Islam, is called an alman. But Tia was saying that the woman is called almana, and the point is that you have the word mana in it. And also that once she's called an almana, then we use a similar word for the man, alman. Anyway, so she's called almana al-shaymana. Okay, the Gemara asks, almana min ha'erusin ma'ikol meima, nu, and what about if she's an almana after the erusin? Now you could have the husband was makadish her, then he passed away before the nisuin, she's still a basula, when she remarries, then when somebody else is makadish her and she gets married, she's still a basula, she's still gonna get a ksuba of 200 zuz, and yet she's called almana. So why? It's the point, if the name almana comes from the word mana. The answer is okay, Fine. Listen, you know, once one kind of woman who's a widow is called an almana, then we use the same name for all widows, whether she's actually a basula or not. Even if in a particular case, she is in fact entitled to 200 zuz. All right, the Gemara asks, almana to ksiva bar isa ma'ikol neimar. Fine, but you have the word almana in the psukim already. Now, there's machloikas at the end of this masechta, whether the ksuba of a basula is daraisa or darabanam. But everybody agrees that the ksuba of a non-basula is definitely dirabanan. So if we're saying that the almana is so named after the value of huksuba, then why is the Torah using that terminology when that takana hadn't been made yet? And the answer is, fine, the Torah is calling her an almana in advance because eventually the chachamim are going to make a takana that she will receive a mana for huksuba. Tosfos, by the way, points out, even if you were going to say, even if hypothetically you could think that maybe the ksuba of an almana is daraisa, it wouldn't work to say that that's the reason for the name, though, because the value, the coin, or the denomination called a mana did not exist in the times of Chumash. The first time you have a mana mentioned anywhere in Tanakh is in Sefer Yechezkel, which is from that particular part of Yechezkel is from after Churban Bayis Rishon. So for Pashtos, it was a measurement or a weight or something that they use in other parts of the world, not necessarily in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, even if you were to say that the actual amount of ksuba is daraisa, it wouldn't have been called a mana. It would have been called however many shkolim. So why the word almana then? How does it refer to a mana if it's in the Torah? And we're saying that that's tidur abanan demesakni lamana, because the chachamim in the future are going to make a takana that she'll get a mana. Question is, miksiv krola osid, does the Torah do that? Does the Torah write something that we're calling something because of something that's going to happen in the future? Sure, obviously there's things where the Torah says what's going to happen in the future, but to call something by a certain name because something is going to happen in the future, where do we find such a thing? I think it was Ain. As a matter of fact, we do. Dichtib, here's an example. By the four rivers that come out of Gan Eden, the Shem HaNohar HaShlishi Chidekel, the third river is called Chidekel, Hu HaHoylech Kidmas Ashur, which is the one that flows east of Ashur, the Toner Rabbi Yosef, Ashur, Zuslika, and Rabbi Yosef tells us that Ashur is the name of a city, and the Ashur is a city that in his times in Babel was called Slika. So now, Mihavoi, when the Eibishter created the world, did Ashur, the city of Slika, exist yet? Of course not, it was built later. Eladasida, so it means it was going to be in the future, and therefore the Pasuk can already write that. Hachanami, Dasida, the same way you could say over here, the word Almana is because in the future there's going to be a mana made for her. So now Tosfos points out, what's the Gemara's question? Sure, Ashur didn't exist by Briyas HaOlam, but it existed by the time the Torah was given to Moshe Rabbeinu. By the time Hashem dictates the Torah to Moshe 2,500 years later, Ashur already exists as a country. So why shouldn't the Torah use the word Ashur? What's bothering the Gemara in the first place? So Tosfos explains that what Rabbi Yosef means by saying Ashur Zuslika means that this city of Slika did not exist yet in Moshe's times. And in other words, Ashur can mean a country, but it can also mean but Rabbi Yosef is saying it doesn't mean the country of Ashur as a whole. It means a specific city called Slika, and the Gemara knows that that city did not yet exist in Moshe's times. So then the question would be, so how is the Torah writing that? And the answer would be because even though the city was built later, the Eberstein knew it was going to be built and named Asher, and therefore he can already dictate that to Moshe in the Torah. So Tosfos explains that's why the Gemara is not bothered by the fact you have the previous river, the Gichon. It says who asoed of Eskol Eretz Kush. The Gemara didn't ask the same question. The land of Kush didn't exist when it didn't exist at the time. Because the answer is fine. By the time Moshe came along, the country of Kush existed, and you could say even from the beginning, maybe even from the beginning, from when the Eidishter created the world, that place was already known as Kush. As soon as Adam came along, and the Medrash said that Adam went and visited all the places in the world to decide what's going to be cultivated and whatnot, so he may have called the place Kush. But here we're saying Asher was a specific city, and that city didn't exist at that time yet. Maushah explains differently, that the vort is, when it comes to Kush and Chavila, which is also mentioned in the Pesukim over there, it says Eretz Chavila and Eretz Kush. So therefore, fine, that means that the countries already existed and had those names. But here, where we're saying Asher is a specific city, then the Pesuk is saying that the river flows east of it, then that city didn't exist at the time, and therefore that's what the Gemara is saying, and yet the Pesuk can write as though it already did, so the same thing with the Almana. So the Gemara continues, having mentioned one thing that Rav Chana Bagadta said, and by the way, we learned yesterday or the day before, what does the name Bagadta mean? Rashi says it means he was from Baghdad. Elsewhere, in other places in Shas, where Rav Chana Bagadta is mentioned, Rashi gives a different explanation. He was a Baal Agadta. He was an expert in Agadta. Anyway, so having brought one thing of him, then the Gemara, as it often does, brings a couple of other statements of his as well. But Amar Rav Chana Bagadta, mutter, the rain has the following good properties. Mashke, it waters the soil. Merave, it slakes the thirst of the soil. In other words, mashke would just be, in other words, it waters the plants. Merave means the earth is partially thirsty for rain, and the rain accomplishes that. Umizabel, and it fertilizes the earth. In other words, it's not just that it wets it. It actually gives it it has the properties of fertilizer. One thing is they've discovered that you have there's nitrogen in the air. That nitrogen is very necessary for some plants. But how does it get out of the air and combine with the plants? One thing is when there's a thunderstorm, the lightning causes the nitrogen molecules to break apart, and then they can get into the soil and they can fertilize the plants. So all part of, we're saying that the Eidishter brings rain and brings thunderstorms with it and all of that, and has the effect of fertilizing the earth with nitrates that are very necessary for the development of plants. Umadain, and it also makes the fruit, beautiful. Rashi explains, noisen edna v'ziv b'peiris. It gives like a shine and a glow to the peiris as a result of the rain. Umamshich, and it draws forth the peiris to grow. So in other words, Rashi explains he's not saying the word mutter stands for these things, but he's saying you should realize the greatness of rain, that it has all of these properties, that it accomplishes all these things. So the hurrah from it apparently is the poshut, when you see it's raining, like this, how many times do you have it's raining and it's such nasty weather or whatever? The point is, Rav Chana Bagadta wants you to know, don't say that. It's got all these good things that it accomplishes for the world. Yishmei bracha, yeah. It's always a bracha, yeah. There's a cute line that I've seen in some of Rabbi Avigdor Miller's writings where he talks about this, about being grateful to the Eibishter for rain and other such things. He says, whenever you see rain falling, imagine that there's fruits falling from the sky, because after all, the fruits are 80 or 90% water, and imagine also that there are Jews falling from the sky, because a person's body is also like 80% water. So that gives you a certain perspective to realize the bracha in it.
Jewish body.
Yeah. Okay. Where's a pasuk that expresses this idea where we see these things that the rain accomplishes? The pasuk says in Tillim, fill up its furrows. So you have the farmers the farmers have plowed the earth and you have furrows in it. So now we're asking Hashem to slake the thirst, fill up those furrows with water, with the rain. Naches gedudeha, give nachas to its multitudes, meaning the people. So the people of the earth, the Gemara in fact mentions in Tainus, another meaning of Nachas Kedudeha, means when it rains, even armies don't go marauding because the rain keeps them inside. So therefore there's a bracha in that also that you have less fighting and less war going on when it rains. Anyway, Birvivim Tumegigena, with showers Hashem you will soften it. Simcha Tevorech, you will bless its plants. So we see we have all those things. So we see that you have the rave, you have the slaking the thirst of the earth. So that's the mashto morave. That's the first two things that Rav Chana had mentioned are in that word rave. Mezabel is represented by Tmurgigena. You cause the earth to be softened and fertilized. And simcha tevorech, that you have the fruits are blessed. That's the ma'adin u'mamshich. That's that it brings forth the fruits to develop and it makes them beautiful. So we see the pasuk is referring to all these brachas that come with rain. Similarly, since we're talking about something that has multiple good things that it accomplishes, so Amar Rabbi Elazar, so Rabbi Elazar says, here's another thing similar to that. Mizbeach. The Mizbeach in the Beis Mikdash. Now, unlike with the rain, where Rabbi Chana Bagav Torah was not taking the word mutter itself and darshaning words out of it, he's just pointing out the properties of rain. Here, Rabbi Elazar is going to take the word Mizbeach itself and break it down to show that it hints at the words for various positive things that the Mizbeach brings to us. Meziach, it removes. Which the Gemara assumes that means it removes Averis, umezin, and it brings mozon, it brings mezonis, it brings parnosa to the Jewish people, because Rashi explains the korbanos come from food after all, so they bring a bracha to our food. Mechaviv, it makes that the Jewish people are beloved to Hashem, umechaper, and it's mechaper for Averis. So the Gemara asks, hainem mechaper, hainem meziach. Wait, aren't mechap, if we say that meziach means removes averus, then meziach and mechaper are the same thing. And the answer is it doesn't. Meziach gzeirus and mechaper avonus. Meziach means that it removes gzeirus that Hashem would have brought, bad gzeirus against the Jewish people, and mechaper means that it's mechaper for the Jewish people's averus. So in other words, all of this is hinted at in the name Mizbeach itself. It stands for mezin and mechabev and all these other things. So Marsha explains that there are different kinds of korbanos, as we know, that are brought on the Beis Mikdash. So therefore, so you have the meziach that removes zeres roys refers particularly to the ketores. We find by the Magefa in Moshe's times after the whole story of Korach, where the ketores took away that zera. Mezin refers to the korban tamid and the other oilers that brought that through them Hashem gives us food as korbani lachmi leishai, that's Hashem's food, so to speak, and through that we get our food. Lachmi leishai, in fact, we darshan as though it's my food for my people, not leishai for my fires, but leishai for my people, for meaning that we get our food as a result of it. Mechabev refers to the korban shlomim, which causes shalom between Hashem and the Jewish people. And mechaper refers to the chatas and the asham. Those are four kinds of korbanos that are brought on the mizbeach, each of which has a different effect as far as the relationship between us and Hashem. The Rebbe once pointed out in a sicha, by the way, you think about it, why are we putting mechaper at the end? Shouldn't mechaper be ahead of everything else? First, the averus have to be forgiven before there can be the mezin and giving mezonos and taking away gzeiros rois and so forth. And the Rebbe says that's exactly the point. Even before the kapara, already the Eibishter loves the Jewish people, and already the Eibishter wants to give us mezonos and so on and so forth, and therefore mechaper is put at the end. Even before you get to the kapara, you already have the meziach and the mezin and the mechaper. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ge'ula, Yudches Kislev. There's the explanation that Rebbe gives in a sicha, one of the many explanations. Why was Hasidus revealed specifically in recent generations? If it's such a vital part of Torah, then it should have been available long before. So one explanation is because the darkness of Golus is getting worse and worse, as we know at the end of Sota, every day Kilolos and Meruba. So therefore, we need a higher light in order to be able to overcome that Choshech. So therefore, the Neshama of the Torah was revealed, and that arouses our deeper latent powers, Sos and the Neshmasa, to be able to overcome that darkness. So now, another point is, we're at the end of Golas, and we have to be preparing for the Golas, and preparing always has to be me'ein of the thing that you're preparing for. So therefore, another way of looking at it is the Eibishter gave us a me'ein, the Eibishter gave us a foretaste of the Gilul Asid, as you have the concept in Kisri Arizal, and it's brought Lahalocha and Magen Avraham, and after Rebbe's Shulchan Aruch, that on Erev Shabbos, you have to taste from the Shabbos food. Tayameh Chaim Zachor, so therefore we have a Tayameh of the Gilul of Mashiach even now. In that sikh, actually, that ever goes and explains how these two things interconnect, these two points about why Hasidus had to be revealed nowadays and so forth. Continuing on Halachas of Muktzah, we started talking about Bosses L'davar Aser. So we talked about if you have something that's only something that's Aser on the Bosses and not something at least as important, that's Mutter, then we're saying that everything becomes a Bosses L'davar Aser and it'd be Aser B'Tiltol. So the example, for example, we suppose that you have the Leifter on the table and you don't have the Chalos or something important on there. Nevertheless, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch goes on to say, the Di'evit, if you have a Tzurich Godel, let's say, for example, one of the candles fell on the table, and you need to shake it off over there, so then you have Poskim who holds that it's only a Bosses if you intended it to stay there the whole Shabbos, and after all, when it comes to the Leichter, very often you have your goiter remove them often from the table, and on Shabbos morning or something, so therefore, according to those Poskim, it may not be considered a Bosses in the first place. Actually, the Alter Rebbe, anyway, mentions that the tablecloth itself may not be considered a bosses anyway. The table would be a bosses, but not necessarily the tablecloth. So then you have more leeway over there. But the better thing to do to begin with is make sure the chalas or something like that is important is on the table before Shabbos, and then you freshfur the whole problem in the first place, because then nothing becomes a bosses l'davar aser, since you have something over there that's perfectly mutter.